One of the first things that I did after graduating college was I loaded up a backpack and I went hiking in the Himalayas. We've got a picture. There it is. That's 22-year-old me. I loaded up this backpack, I flew to Nepal, and I hiked to the base camp of Mount Everest. And there's something about hiking amongst the world's tallest mountains that makes you feel very small, but like in a good way. The emotion, if we want to get technical, is awe, right? Awe is this overwhelming sort of emotion that you feel when you are in the presence of something that is either really big or really beautiful or both. And the Himalayas are that. They're awesome. But for as awesome as the mountains are, and they are truly awesome, nothing could really prepare me for what I experienced one night on the trek to Mount Everest. One night I woke up and I really had to go pee. And I was staying, like, along the way, I was staying in, like, these mountain huts, but I woke up in the middle of the night. I really had to pee. And I climbed out of my sleeping bag to go to this outhouse that was sort of like near the hut on a little ridge line. As I was sort of walking to this outhouse, I rubbed the sleep out of my eyes. I could see the outhouse a few yards away. I could see, of course, mountains all around us. But when I looked up at the night sky, it made me dizzy because the stars were so bright and so many and so much around me that it felt like I was falling. And I stumbled to my feet and I started to kind of crawl on all fours because I got dizzy and I sort of lost my balance. I remember distinctly being in the outhouse. We actually have a picture too of what similar, I did not take this photograph, but this is akin to what I saw, except it was sort of like 3D. I distinctly remember being in that outhouse and ducking. Not because the outhouse was too small, but it felt like I was ducking under the stars because the weight of them, it just felt like it was so close and so much above me that I had to sort of hunch over as I was going to the bathroom that night. And as I got back out, I had to crawl back to the hut and sort of climb back into my sleeping bag. I will never forget the moment. It was one of the most awesome experiences of my life. But you know what is interesting about this story, in some ways, at least it is to me, is that for most of human history, every human being alive, everywhere in the world, lived under a night sky like that. Like, this wasn't just something like this one-off event on this like once-in-a-lifetime kind of trip. Every night, every human being would just step outside and they would see the Milky Way. They lived under this awesome night sky. They lived under this sparkling canopy that evoked awe and wonder. When you look up at the night sky like that, maybe the closest thing that you'll get to that is actually at Craftsbury when you come on the fall retreat with us, right? You can see stars kind of like that out there. But when you look up at a starry night sky, it seems like the word wow just escapes you. Almost like the stars themselves kind of give you a little punch in the gut, and wow is the sound your body makes when stars punch you in the stomach. It's hard to suppress. It's hard to contain because it's awesome. It's wonderful. But check this. Because of light pollution, only 20% of the world's population can see the stars at night now. Means 80% of the world's population, when they step outside, they don't see stars. We got a picture of this too. 80% of the world's population, when they step outside, they see a glowing haze, or blinking lights, or flashing billboards. Instead of the heavens, they just see mankind reflected back at them. When they step out at night, it's like they can't get past themselves. Is it a coincidence that some of the most secular places on the planet are also some of the places that experience the worst light pollution? Just think about that for a minute. Is it a coincidence that some of the most secular places on the planet are also some of the places that experience the most light pollution? that in those places where the stars are no longer visible, it becomes plausible that there is nothing beyond us. In these places where the stars are no longer visible, people insist that the only things that are real and true are the things that are immediate and here and now, because there's nothing beyond. Is that a coincidence? I don't think it is. When you stare at the night sky, your mind, like a sky full of stars, your mind naturally wanders and it wonders. And you start thinking big existential questions like, what are we doing here? Like where do we fit in the cosmos? And who am I and why am I here? I mean, I just think that happens. Kira is nodding. I think maybe, at least it happens to two of us. I think it probably happens to you too. Why is there something rather than nothing? Why am I here? Why are we here? A starry sky lends itself to those kinds of questions, but a light-polluted sky, not so much. Our modern secular culture tells us a modern secular story where man is at the center of all things. There's no God. There's just this present moment, just this here and now. A story that honestly is reflected back to us by our light-polluted skies. But this is just a story. And all it takes is for you to step outside and maybe travel a little ways to see that it's only just a story. And I hope you'll agree, probably not the best story for making sense of the world that we live in. Maybe a story that can only gain real traction in a world devoid of stars. Tonight, I want to ask you a question that is posed by the night sky. Why is there something rather than nothing? Why does anything exist at all? And we can make this personal. Why are you here? And I don't just mean like here in the Interfaith Center on a Wednesday night, but like, why are you here? Like, why do you exist? There's two ways that we can answer that tonight. First, looking at the modern secular story, like its answer to that question. But then I want to introduce you to this, the biblical answer, the story that Jesus tells. And I think invite you to believe a better story. First, the modern secular story. Why are you here? Why is there something rather than nothing? The modern secular story insists, we can lose this picture. The modern secular story insists that there is no point to your being. That you are simply here by accident. This is a pretty blunt way of putting it. But a long time ago, the universe farted. And it released a lot of gas. And we are here as some sort of fart residue. It's quite an image. Right? There's no meaning to a fart. You can explain why a fart happened by explaining how it happened. But it is insane to try to explain what a fart means. A fart says nothing, and a fart means nothing. It's here today and gone tomorrow, hopefully sooner than that. Right? It might linger, but eventually it dissipates and it disappears. And so the modern secularists say, they say, so will you. So will the universe. It is a fart. That's kind of metaphysics for like a third grader. I hope I didn't lose you. I have a third grader at home. So there you go. Crash course in metaphysics for Willeminen and company. But I want you to hear, but it is, I mean, I'm not lying. That is kind of the answer as to why you're here. And I want you to hear how the modern secular storytellers, right, the sages of our age, how they narrate that story. The universe is a fart. You are a fart. You're here today, gone tomorrow. It means nothing. I want you to hear in their own words how they tell it to you, okay? Stephen Jay Gould in Life magazine. He's an evolutionist, a paleontologist. He says, and I quote, "We are here because one odd group of fishes had a peculiar fin anatomy that could transform into legs for terrestrial creatures. Because the earth never froze entirely during an ice age. Because a small and tenuous species arising in Africa a quarter of a million years ago has managed so far to survive by hook and by crook. We may yearn for a higher answer, but none exists." Stephen Hawking. "The human race is just a chemical scum on a moderate-sized planet orbiting around a very average star in the outer suburb of one among 100 billion galaxies. Carl Becker: from a scientific standpoint, human beings are little more than a chance deposit on the surface of the world, carelessly thrown up between two ice ages by the same forces that rust iron and ripen corn. And Bertrand Russell: this one is a mouthful, but I'm going to read it slowly, and it's weighty. Man is the product of causes which had no prevision of the end they were achieving. His origin, his growth, his hopes and fears, his loves and his beliefs are but the outcome of accidental collocations of atoms. No fire, no heroism, no intensity of thought and feeling can preserve an individual life beyond the grave. All the labors of the ages, all the devotion, all the inspiration, all the noonday brightness of human genius are destined to extinction in the vast death of the solar system. And the whole temple of man's achievement must inevitably be buried beneath the debris of a universe in ruins. All these things, if not quite beyond dispute, are yet so nearly certain that no philosophy which rejects them can hope to stand. Gould, Hawkins, Becker, Russell, they are all saying the same thing, albeit with some fancy language. You are a fart, and the universe is a fart, and all of it and all of you means nothing. But there is another way to answer this question. Why am I here? And why is there something rather than nothing? All of that is the story that is spoken over you and sort of pressed into you in this place at the University of Vermont and by our culture. Like, we hear that all the time. It's a popular story. But as you've heard me say, just because it's popular doesn't make it the only story. And just because it's popular doesn't make it true. There are other stories out there. And Jesus comes to you with one. And I want you to hear it. There is another way to answer this question, another story that gives its rise. Why am I here? Why is there something rather than nothing? And you can see it printed for you in your handout. It is in some ways summarized in the first line of the Apostles' Creed. I believe in the Father Almighty, creator of heaven and earth. The Bible begins on page 1, line 1. The Bible begins with these words: in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And what precedes isn't so much a scientific account of creation, but a theological one. It's not so much explaining how God made the world, but explaining what he made. And what he made was good. What he made was beautiful. What he made was awesome. God brought order out of chaos. The world was shapeless and void, but he started creating spaces, and then he filled them. Created sort of kingdoms, and then set things over them to rule over them. He created the sun and the moon to rule over the day and the night. He created fish and birds to rule over the sea and the sky. And he created creepy things and crawling things to rule over the dry land. And everything is good. Everything is good because everything is in its right place and it's doing what it was designed to do. It is good. It is good. Seven times it is good. But we are still pressed for an answer. Why? Why something rather than nothing? If you read the Bible, you can say with confidence, because God wanted it to exist. We are here because God willed it. He wants us to be here. This, all of you, was not an accident. This was willed. You were willed. You were chosen to exist. God spoke, and therefore it happened. We are here because God wants us to be here. But again, like a good third grader might ask, but why? Was God lonely? Was God bored and needed something to do? Did he need something or someone to love? Or someone to love him in return? No. None of these. God did not create the universe because he needed love. God created the universe because God wanted to share it. He didn't need it. He has always had it. He created us. He created all of this because he wanted to generously share love. There's an amazing passage at the end of Genesis 1 where we are told about the creation of mankind, verses 26 through 27. Scriptures read, "Then God said," listen closely, "then God said, let us make man in our image, according to our likeness. They will rule the fish of the sea, the birds of the sky, the livestock, the whole earth, and the creatures that crawl on the earth." So God created mankind in his own image. He created him in the image of God. He created them, male and female. In verse 26, the Creator God says, "Let us make mankind in our image." Not "let me make mankind in my image," but "let us make mankind in ours." This right here is the very first hint of the Trinitarian nature of God, which the Creed most certainly reflects: Father, Son, and Spirit. For all of eternity, before there was a universe, before there was like a big bang, there was God. And this one God forever and ever existed as three loving persons: Father, Son, and Spirit. Because this is true, God was never bored. And God was never, ever lonely. Because God has forever existed in loving community. 1 John, which we read in the New Testament, 1 John 4, tells us that God is love. And God is love because God has always been in loving relationships. The Father loving the Son loving the Father, and the Spirit sharing in that love. And this same God of love says, "Let us make mankind in our image." Let's make beings that reflect this community of love that's been going on forever and ever. See, the Bible tells us that we, human beings, were created in love for the sake of imaging love, right? Reflecting God back to the creation, reflecting God back to each other, and reflecting God back to himself. The reason anything exists at all, the reason why we are here, the reason why you personally exist, it's not simply that God willed it and spoke it into existence. The reason why we're here is because a God of love made you in love for the sake of loving him and loving others and loving the world around you. That's why you're here. These are two very different stories. And they lead you to two very different places. Because what we believe about the world shapes how we live in it, doesn't it? Right, the story that we see our lives as a part of, in large part, determines sort of our script. How are we going to play our part well? Your life is a fart. Your life is infused with meaning because you're made in the image of a God of love. Which is it? They both can't be true. Tonight, with my words, I want to rip the roof off of this building. Like, I want to blow away the clouds and the light that pollutes our air. If I could, I would want you to see the stars in the night sky. And I want you to make some connections, to connect some dots, as it were. There is someone who spoke every one of those stars into existence, who knows them by name, and who knows you by name. The reason you're here is because he wants you to be here. He desires to be in a relationship with you. He did not create you because he's bored or lonely. You exist, and all of us exist, because he is love and full of love, and he wants you to participate in that love. This is the best answer that can possibly be given to this question: why is there something rather than nothing? If you believe the secular story, you have to deny and kill in your heart everything that is good and beautiful in the world. If you believe the secular story, anytime you come into contact with something that is beautiful and lovely and awesome, you have to kill that thought. It's all meaningless. It's all a fart. You have to just sort of try to push the thoughts away. In some ways, put your head in the sand and deny what is most, in some ways, what is most real to you, the things that you love the most. You have to deny those things if you believe the secular story. Christianity, on the other hand, says think more. If you think that life is meaningless, you're not thinking deep enough. You need to think more. You need to feel more. It is far more life-affirming and far more rational, right? This is the story that makes the most sense. It makes sense of the beautiful detail that is poured into every flower and feather. It makes the most sense of the beauty of the person that you are and the feelings that you feel. This feeling that you have that, like, when you wake up today, you're like, my life matters and the people around me matter and my choices matter. This story makes the most sense of that. Daily occurrence. You are not a random collocation of atoms. And the ones that you love are not random collocations of atoms either. The reason that you feel love is the most powerful force in the world is because it is. Because it is at the root of all things. That is coming from a God of love who is before all things. This, friends, is the better story. This is the story that makes the most sense of your life. So we can say, I believe in the Father Almighty, creator of heaven and earth. Amen.